Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories, making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Good afternoon and welcome. Welcome to the show today. My guest today is one of my favorite nonfiction authors. Her resume is so long, it's so long that I'm going to weave some of it throughout today's conversation. But I'll start out by telling you that she has to be one of today's most prolific writers. 26 of her 28 books have been on the New York Times bestseller list, sometimes two at a time. And four of her books have been made into TV movies, and five more are in the works. My guest is Anne Rule. She's a former Seattle police officer who knows the crime scene firsthand. She's a certified instructor for police training seminars and lectures frequently to law enforcement officers, prosecutors, and to forensic science organizations, including the FBI. So for more than two decades, Anne has been a powerful advocate of victims of violent crime. She's testified before U.S. Senate Judiciary Subcommittees on serial murder and victims' rights, and she holds a doctorate in humane letters from Willamette University. Anne is often referred to as America's number one true crime writer and was certainly integral in developing the genre as we know it today. Anne's latest release is called Too Late to Say Goodbye, and it's a true story of murder and betrayal. Anne Rule, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you so much.
I'm so pleased to have you here, and I want to let our listeners know I was trying to get hold of you, and I kept getting voicemail full messages on your voicemail, and then when you cleared out your voicemail, there'd be a polite message on there saying, I'm on deadline, please call back later.
Yeah, I just finished another book Friday. I sent it in, so...
Yeah, so this was your first weekend off. You were just saying you've had no time off over the summer.
No.
Well, I appreciate you being here, and I know that you're taking a well-earned break right now. So I think it's important to say, I know that most people probably know your name, Anne, but for those who don't, I think it's important to say that the true crime that you write about doesn't... even begin to relate to the sensationalized headlines that we see some, you know, in some books and some magazines. And you write about true crime because you're interested in the why behind the behavior.
Yes, from the time I was a little girl, and I used to spend summer vacations at my grandpa's, and he was a sheriff in Michigan, and I was always wondering, why are those people in the jail? They seem so nice. And I'd help my grandma serve the meals to them, and they were so polite. And so that has, for my whole life, I've wondered why some people will develop to be kind and loving and caregivers, and other people are cruel and seem to have no conscience. And in my book, with each case, I try to go back as many generations as I can and to see what influenced the child to grow up as he or she did.
Mm.
So that interests me, and over the years, more and more, I realize I'm telling the victim's story because they don't have any voice anymore. And it's very important that the readers know who they were and can really understand what the loss was.
Sure. And I read that you look at three areas in your books. You look, as you said, at the victim's stories. You look at the detectives and prosecutors,
uh-huh,
and how they combine police work and forensic science, uh-huh, and then you look at the killers' lives. Have you found any common denominator with those people, with the killers?
Well, 25 years ago, I thought I had it all solved, and I thought it was all early childhood abuse or abandonment or neglect, and certainly that plays into how killers develop. But I think there may even be a tendency toward violent behavior that's almost genetic. And if babies are born into loving homes, we may never know that that was there. But if you get the unfortunate combination of a tendency toward violence and and in a cool home, then you have the perfect soil to grow a human personality with no conscience.
Mm-hmm. So I want to just, we're going to talk about your book and we'll get into this in more detail, but I want to look at the woman behind the name Ann Rule and how you grew up and what led you to where you're at right now. And you just mentioned you were born in Michigan. I didn't know that. I thought you were local to Seattle.
No. Came from Michigan and I lived there for the first 15 years of my life. My dad was a coach. And so coaching is like politics, I guess. You go wherever. If things are good, you move. And if things are bad, you move. And my dad moved from Michigan to Oregon to Willamette University and then back, then to Stanford and then to Slippery Rock University in Pennsylvania. So we moved a lot, and I went my first 2 years of college down in Oregon, but I came up to go to the university here, and I just felt like I'd come home. Mm-hmm. So I feel like a native. I've lived here for all but my first 20 years.
Mm-hmm. You don't know this, but you were one of the first people I met when I moved to Seattle.
But tell me, where did we meet?
Well, it was actually at Bellevue Library, and I moved to Seattle from California.
Oh,
I knew nobody here.
Okay.
And so I'd gone down to the library, and I thought, okay, let's see if there's any clubs or organizations around here. And it just so happened that that evening you were giving a talk on one of your latest books at the time.
Yeah.
And so I got a chance to listen to you talk and then meet you very briefly afterwards. So it was very interesting.
Well, it's kind of hard. It's good for us to have to move and start over, but it can be difficult at first. And obviously, it took with you. You're still here.
That's right. So, you've got 5 children and 6 grandchildren, I read.
Let me see. I'm getting the last count. Yes, I do. I have 4 natural-born children and then an adopted son and 6 grandchildren, yes.
Hmm. Now, so how did you get from, you were at the University of Washington,
mm-hmm.
did you become a police officer straight from the University of Washington?
I did. I majored in creative writing with no intent to be a writer. It just it was an easy A for me. And, you know, I took so many writing courses and never paid attention to somebody tugging at my sleeve saying, maybe that's what you should do, but I graduated from the university and went right down and became a Seattle police officer and worked for about a year and a half, but I'm so nearsighted that in those days you could not wear contact lenses. You had to have at least 20/40 vision, and I was, I think, 20/200 in one eye and 20/100 in my good eye, and that was the end of my police career and the biggest disappointment of my life. And never knowing that things were going to turn out okay down the line.
And so where did you go from there, Anne, when you could no longer do what you really wanted to do?
Well, another thing I wanted to do was get married and have children, but I went from the police department to the State Department of Public Assistance and was a caseworker for about a year, and then my husband had been in ROTC, so he was transferred back to Niagara Falls and to El Paso and had my first baby. And so I stayed home and had 4 children, and when I could see my marriage was coming to an end and I would be the one supporting the children because Bill developed melanoma shortly after we divorced and died at the age of 42.
Mm.
I wanted something where I could stay home and be with them and not have to leave them every day, and remembered writing, which was always something that I enjoyed so much, and managed to cobble together a career writing first articles for like the Sunday magazines for the Times and the PI back in the day when there were 2 Sunday papers, and they had a lot of articles in their magazine sections. And then I wrote True Confessions, so I ran out of fantasies to confess about. And And then I got the job as the stringer representing the Northwest for True Detective Magazine and four other detective magazines, and the New York Daily News and the Chicago Tribune. And I had found my niche and was fascinated and went back to college and got a degree in police science and attended every seminar that the various police departments would let me go to, along with working officers, and had found what interested me the most and probably what I was best at.
You make it sound so easy. I'm sure it wasn't while you were trying to raise...
It wasn't. We were so poor. We were so poor for so long. And back in the day, I think I made about $12,000 to $14,000 a year in the '70s, and that wasn't, you know, that was a lot more in the '70s than it is now.
Sure.
But with kids coming up, it was hard.
Yeah, I'm sure it was. And not easy to write with them running around you either.
Well, it teaches you you can write to anything if you're determined.
Mm.
People tell me, "Oh, someday I'm going to write," and I just need a cabin where everything's quiet. And it doesn't work that way. If you want to write, you will find a way. And I always say, if the kids weren't actively fighting on top of my typewriter, I would have to stop and scrape them off. But I could go right back to work.
Yeah, especially if you want to get paid.
Yeah.
Amazing how you can develop blinkers and earmuffs when you need to get paid for something.
When you need to buy groceries the next week, you get your work done.
True. Now, and you've been writing this full time as a true crime writer since 1969, I believe. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that was my very first story sold to, True Detective.
Mm-hmm.
And I ended up doing well over 1,000 true cases. Great training ground for what was to come later. I wasn't even thinking of writing a book at that point.
Mm-hmm. So what did you get your stories from detectives? I'm assuming you kept relationships with certain detectives around the area, or did you just read the newspaper and think, I'm going to write about that?
In the beginning, of course, I just read the newspapers and found out that anybody can go to a trial unless it's a juvenile hearing, and some of those are closed to the public. And after I had to prove myself to the detectives, my territory was the Canadian border down to Eugene and then east over in halfway into Montana. They're a suspicious lot, and they have to play their cards close to their vest, and they had to learn that they could tell me things that I couldn't yet write. And when they saw they could trust me, then the doors opened up, and they talked to fellow detectives that they met in other states, and then they would call me. And now, of course, I hear from prosecutors and detectives and readers all over America. I probably get 20 suggestions every day for cases to write now.
Now, I know I read on your website that you don't take cases that are really sensationalized, and you don't take really gory, you know, bodies in the freezer kind of cases.
No, you know, people will write to me and say, oh, you know, I've got a great case of a woman who decapitated her husband and put him in the freezer, and I know it's a good case for you. That would not be. Or cases where there's torture and real cruelty, because I have to spend a year of my life thinking about, I'm totally immersed in what I'm writing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just too emotionally upsetting. And I really don't want people to read about it that much. I'm more interested in, I usually say a psychological autopsy of behavior before and after the crime. And I don't want to describe the grotesque details, nor will I use pictures. There's a lot of the quickie paperbacks in true crime will try to get the most awful, gruesome pictures.
Mm-hmm.
And I figure that everybody has somebody who loves them, and they should never have to see pictures like that.
Sure.
So I won't use them.
Sure. I think also One of the first places I turn to actually is the pictures when I'm looking at a book like that. And because I like to kind of look at the people and then put, you know, their face to what you're writing about.
I do too. Yeah.
And so, and I certainly appreciate the fact that you don't put those kind of pictures in there. Is there ever a case that you wish you'd had not taken?
Not really. I think one that I would not do again, because it was very upsetting to me, but the book is still selling, and it did serve to keep the killer in prison for 35 years. He died last year, and that was Lust Killer.
Mm-hmm.
And it was gruesome, and the guy was a torturer. But I had a chance to explore his childhood, to talk to the detective who really did a remarkable job on solving it. And I'm glad I did it, but I don't think I could stand to write it again. At least on Sunny.
Sure.
In the beginning, I was so afraid that I'd get desensitized and that I would get tough. And instead, I went the other way. I got sensitized to the grief and the tragedy, which I'm glad for.
Interesting.
But
yeah, interesting.
That's one book. If someone came to me today with that case, I probably wouldn't write it.
Hmm. Well, let's take a break. And when we come back, I'd like you to give a brief synopsis of your book. I have a copy that we're going to give away to a caller today.
Good.
And we'll do that as soon as we come back from the break. So please stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
How would your life be different if you had the guidance of a psychic, intuitive, medium, or energy healer? And how exciting would it be to discover your own inherent spiritual gifts of intuition and wisdom? Find out when you tune in to our enlightening talk radio show, Sage, Spirit, Angels, and Guides Entertainment, every Friday at noon on 1150 AM KKNW and streaming live on the internet at sageradioshow.com. Call in, speak with sages from around the world, and receive guided insight for your life. Don't just imagine the possibilities, live them.
Do you love wildlife? Then make a real difference by helping PAWS care for sick and injured wild animals. Volunteers help feed and clean the animals until they are well enough to return to the wild. Sign up today and help save a wild life. No experience necessary. All training is provided. Visit PAWS.org or call 425-787-2500.
Talk radio with a difference. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And my guest today is Anne Rule. She's America's foremost true crime writer. And we're talking about her latest book today, a riveting real-life drama, a heartbreaking story of treachery, jealousy, and murder, and of two women who learned the truth too late. So having said all that, Anne, I wonder if you could give us a synopsis in your own words about the book, and then we'll open up the phone lines to our listeners, and somebody can have a copy, free copy of the book.
Good. Well, this is a case that came to me from the neighbor of one of the victims in a little town outside of Atlanta, Georgia. And the victim was a lovely young wife and mother, 32 years old, who was found December 4th, 204, dead in her bed with a gun, a handgun, and a bullet wound in her head. And at first was thought to be a suicide. And as the detective started to write it off, they heard from someone that the woman's husband was a dentist, very handsome, fairly successful dentist, and it turned out that he had been engaged in at least dating another woman 14 years earlier who died in an almost identical scenario over in Augusta on the other side of the state. And so they started to investigate, and this is the story of domestic violence and of a man who had to, he had to be the one, and I've written about a lot of guys like this, they have to be the one to say goodbye. They will not allow women to walk away from them.
Mm.
As I got deeper into this book, and of course I went back to Atlanta and Augusta, there were so many startling things happened that no one could ever have predicted. And bless the two prosecutors' offices. They gave me access to thousands of pages of files and photos and tapes of interviews. So I was able to tell the complete story. But it was a heartbreaker, and it still is. I got so close to the parents that you can't help but... And because I have girls the age of their daughters. And
sure.
To feel their loss. But the one thing I think I've done is let the reader know who these women really were.
And you did a great job of that. I did feel as though I knew these women. So let's go ahead, Eric, and open up the phone lines. Eric Ryder's here right with me. And we're going to open up the phone lines to listeners if you'd like to get a copy of this book.
All right, should we give it to caller number 4 today?
Sounds good.
Lucky number 4. There give us a call at 425-373-5527. That's 425-373-5527 or toll free in Western Washington, 888-298-KKNW. That's 888-298-5569.
All right, fabulous. The lines are opening right now. Thanks, Eric. So, Anne, how many months did you spend at trial on this one? I know these books take over your life totally.
They do. Actually, in the end, there was no trial. But I had to wait 2.5 years because there were supposed to be 2 trials. And I'd have my plane fare and my hotel reservations and a car ready to rent in Georgia. And the day before, I'd get a phone call that it's been postponed for another 3 months. Three months, sometimes 6 months. I probably spent about 6 months doing research. And because it was postponed for so long, I really was under a tight deadline, and it only took me about 4 months to write. But that means sitting down in October and getting up in March and not having, taking Christmas and Thanksgiving off, and I think that was all.
Mm-hmm.
In a way, for the book, it's good to work that way because there's a flow where you're just in there. Oh, I did have 9 forced days. Remember the windstorm in December?
Mm-hmm.
And oh, how frustrating. I had no power for 9 days. And I'd been working so hard, and of course, my computer wouldn't work. And I finally got a generator. They were in short supply, and I got it 15 minutes before the power went back on in my house. So... but I spent a lot of time on this case, and still do. I've had more email and mail on this book than I think any book I've ever written.
Interesting. And the book, of course, is called Too Late to Say Goodbye. Once you've got all of your research, how do you go about beginning to write that? Because there's so many facts that you have to cross-check. I would imagine it's a nightmare.
No, it's like a puzzle. It really is. I surround myself with all of the transcripts, or in this case, there were some transcripts from court hearings and things like that. But with the police interviews and the police reports, which are essential, and the autopsy report, and then I decide I'm going to jump into a book. I picture somebody in a bookstore picking up and looking at the first page and deciding whether they want to buy it or not. So I always start at a very interesting, exciting, or puzzling place. And start the book there, and then I will go back as far back as I need to be and write until I get up to that place. And then kind of braid... the backstory and the forward story together. I think I learned the technique from reading Silas Marner back in the 7th grade, and I couldn't see any point in reading that book then, but now I see why.
What was that book called?
Silas Marner by George Eliot.
Oh, okay.
It's one of those. It's about a old miser who adopted an orphan girl.
Mm.
And everybody in Michigan in the seventh grade had to read it. But it was well worth it. Structure is everything when you're writing a book. Once you get your structure, then you know where to hang your facts.
Sure.
And go ahead.
I was going to say, do you start writing after the trial's over, or do you do anything before then?
I do a little bit beforehand, but often I find that I'll have to erase and start over. So I'll take notes. Mm-hmm. I may have whole conversations that I know will go someplace in the book. I'm not quite sure where they're going to go. And one of the things that's exceptionally important to me is that the reader feels as if he or he is in the place where it all happened. So I want to describe the temperature, what the air feels like, what flowers are growing, what their favorite thing to eat is in the area, and so that I'm walking through the case, but the reader's walking along with me. And a lot of them have said they feel like they're there, and so then I know that I've done a good job of of bringing them along.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. What was it about this particular story that made it unique enough that you wanted to spend that amount of time and effort telling the story?
I'm always looking for a bad guy or a bad girl who is the last person that anyone would suspect was a killer. People who have not all of these things, but most of them, physical attractiveness, education, charisma, talent, wealth, love in their lives, the things that most of us think, well, if I had that, I'd be happy. But these people aren't, because they never get enough.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't care who gets in their way, because the rest of us, to them, we're like paper dolls or six figures. And so they will take what they want. And eventually, most of them are revealed as to what they really are. But it's interesting to follow them during the time when everybody thinks they're perfect. And if I have, I need a protagonist, an anti-hero like that, and then I need a case that is not a slam dunk. I don't want one where the police know immediately what happened. There has to be some mystery to it. And the victim has to be, victim or victims, I have to be somebody that the reader cares about. And, of course, every life is important, but in some you see the tragedy and the irony so much more than others.
Mm-hmm.
And my biggest problem right now is that television, A&E and Court TV and 48 Hours and Dateline and investigative files, they will leap on a case before it goes to trial.
Mm.
And they almost just worry all of the juice out of it by repeating coverage again and again. So I've always looked for what I call sleepers, cases that people don't know about. And that, but boy, is that getting hard to do.
Yeah, I would imagine it is. But actually, you get to know the victims better, and you get to understand, I think, the why behind the behavior better in when you're reading
a
book.
I know I can do a lot more in depth, and there's a lot more detail that I can do in 500 pages that they can't do in half an hour to an hour with commercials interspersed. But I'd love the internet, because I could go on and say, anybody who knows this person or anything about this case, please get in touch. And people have. And I found out, for instance, in this case, I heard from a girlfriend of the killer, a girlfriend from 20 years back who was living in Europe. And she was able to give me the motivation that nobody else knew about.
Mm.
But now if I put on what I'm working on, then Court TV will jump on it too. So it's between a rock and a hard place.
Yeah. some of the women you've written about who've been victimized like this have been extraordinarily smart. I'm thinking in particularly of, I think it was Dead by Sunset with Bradley Cunningham. His wife was an attorney. His new, I think he ended up marrying the second one. She was an anesthesiologist.
He didn't have anyone who didn't have at least a master's degree.
So what is it in smart women like that? What lessons can we learn from what they ignored? I know they say love is blind, and there's true psychological factors behind that saying, but in this case, the love had already gone. So what is it in these women that allows them to turn a blind eye and not really see that behavior, which to an outsider might have seemed very obvious?
Well, whenever I lecture, I will ask, I'll say, everybody in the audience who has never been a fool for love, raise your hand. There are very few hands. We all are looking for love. We all tend to, I've done it, and I think I'm smart, but we tend to paste an outline of what we want in a man over the real man. And we don't, and when we're falling in love, we don't look for the warning signs. And that's one of the things I think I'm able to do in my books is give women a heads up, because it doesn't matter if have a PhD or if you've only been through junior high school, you may want to believe that the man that you're falling in love with is perfect, and you will ignore the signals. But they're so common. Abusive men will, if they seem to be so jealous, and in the beginning it's kind of flattering that they want to be with you all the time, and they don't want you to look at another man, and then it moves on, well, they don't really want you to spend time with your family,
mm-hmm.
Or your friends, and they cut you off so you're isolated, and then they will begin to chip away at a woman's ego and make her feel stupid. It doesn't matter if she's a doctor. Make her feel unattractive, often even cut her off from her profession unless he's enjoying the income that comes from that profession. And then you start with the verbal abuse, and then it goes often to physical abuse. And women get so isolated and without funds and without all sorts of resources that they're afraid to leave, and often they're afraid to leave for good reason, because the men are threatening to kill them if they leave. And it's a progression. And I've had so many women write and say, oh, I recognize myself. I recognize my boyfriend, and thank you. You've given me the impetus and the guts to leave.
Mm.
And I'm so glad when I hear that. And I do have a website with, we have a guest book that turned out to be one of the nicest things, and I just meant it for informational, but it's the most supportive group of women. There are a few men, but it's mostly women, not just in America, but all over the world,
mm-hmm.
who are most supportive to each other and will help a woman to leave or give her hints on how to leave safely if she's in a dangerous situation.
Sure. That's good. And that's on your website.
Yeah, it's just that my website is www.annrules. It's my name just with an S on the end, .com. And once you get there are many sections, as you've probably seen, but it's the mm-hmm. guest book. You just click under guest book, and then I have a blog, and I have a photo section and a newsletter and frequently asked questions. And then updates on what people from earlier books are doing now.
Yeah, I saw that, and I was surprised. There was a story that you covered called Small Sacrifices, and Farrah Fawcett Major played Diane Downs in the TV miniseries.
Yeah.
And I think I read there, or maybe somewhere else, that she's coming up for parole soon. Is that correct?
Diane, I think, comes up for parole in 2010.
Mm-hmm.
Her father, who has now started a website. It's the same old, where they claim it was a bushy-haired stranger that stopped her car in, along a lonely road down near Eugene, Oregon, and shot her and her children. And there's no new information, but every once in a while, she will convince somebody that she's innocent. And I know for a while there was somebody in Europe, some man in Europe who completely ignored the real evidence.
Mm-hmm.
And there is real evidence.
Well, didn't her daughter testify against her? Didn't her daughter say that mommy shot me?
Yeah. Christy was 8 when she and her sister and her brother were shot. And she almost died. But she had a stroke, and the stroke was in the speech areas of her brain. And it took months and months for her to get her speech back. Luckily, in a child that young, under 11, there's so much free brain available that the whole brain can be reprogrammed. And so first Christy had to get her brain to work correctly again, and then she didn't want to remember what she had seen. And so she had a therapist, but the therapist bent over backwards not to give any suggestions at all, to let Christy remember when she could, if she could. Mm-hmm. And finally she did remember. I remember the therapist said, "You write who did it on this piece of paper," and she said, "If you don't feel comfortable giving it to me, you can throw it in the fireplace when we stop talking today." And time after time, Christy would throw that piece of paper that she'd written on in the fireplace, and finally she was able to hand over the paper, and it said, "Mom did it."
Mm.
But it was that little girl to get up in court and look into her mother's eyes, and her mother has those very Sanpaku eyes, the Japanese call them, with a lot of white under the pupils.
Mm.
But Christy did it. And those kids are now, Christy, I think, is 31 now.
Mm-hmm.
And her mother, she's married to a son of a policeman, and she has a child. The kids are doing fine.
Well, that's good. That's good to hear, because it was a very traumatic experience
awful
for them.
Just a terrible thing.
Yeah, let's take a break, Anne, and we'll be right back, and we'll announce the winner of the book today. And you're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. My guest is Anne Rule. Please stay with us.
Are your services receiving the attention you've earned and deserve? Is your business growing as quickly as you'd like it to? More importantly, is it as profitable as it could be? We know it's easy to get overlooked in the crowd. Let our marketing experts shine a spotlight on you and your business by delivering your strategic message to thousands of people in the Northwest region and thousands more via the internet. Learn how our expertise can help put your name out there and increase awareness of your business. Call Conversations Live today at 253-302-3286 or email info@conversationslive.net. That's 253-302-3286 or email info@conversationslive.net.
Dating is fast-paced, flirty fun in a safe, no-pressure environment. Gig Harbor Speed Dates is the South Sound's best social opportunity for busy single people. Check us out at gigharborspeeddates.com. Make friends, business contacts, or maybe even a love connection. Go to gigharborspeeddates.com.
Click the shows page on 1150kknw.com for the scoop on Alternative Talk 1150 AM.
And welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And my guest today is author Anne Rule. She's America's foremost true crime writer. And her latest book is called Too Late to Say Goodbye. And before I forget, I shall announce today's book winner, and that is Katie B. in Everett. Thank you, everyone, for calling in today. Katie, we will get that out in the mail to you this week. And there are so many changes happening in forensic science today. And I was watching a show the other evening where several people were being let out of prison after a good number of years, some of them like 17, 20 years, based on forensic evidence that we have today, DNA. What's your take on that? What do you have to say about forensic challenges that we have today?
Oh, it's changed so much. When I started, and it was over 25 years ago, and I mean, I went back to school, and George Ishii, who was director of the Western Washington Crime Lab, taught the class in crime scene investigation, and he said, one day we will be able to take a drop of blood, and we will be able to match that drop of blood to only one person in the whole world unless he's an identical twin. And we all thought, oh, sure, yeah. And, of course, that was DNA, and it did come to pass. It's changed. When I started, there we didn't know what DNA was, that you could isolate someone with not just blood but bodily fluids, sometimes hair, and automated fingerprint, computerized fingerprint comparison. Used to be that you had to have all 10 fingerprints of whoever a suspect might be in order to get a match, unless he was one of the FBI's 10 most wanted. They kept a complete set of their fingerprints, and now you can feed it into a computerized bank and find somebody. Most people at some time in their life or other have had their fingerprints taken. Same way there's now a computer bank of sex offenders. So things have changed tremendously. I worked starting in the 80s on the violent criminal apprehension program, where we linked police departments with similar cases to each other across the country so they could see the patterns and catch serial killers more rapidly. So we were almost in the Stone Age. The only thing that has remained true, and there was probably the first criminalist, Dr. Emile Locard in France, who came up with this theory that said every criminal leaves something of himself at the crime scene, no matter how minute, and he takes something of the crime scene away with him, no matter how minute. Now we have the tools to find those infinitesimal pieces of evidence that got lost before. Yeah. And even with the Green River Killer, until the mid-90s, you needed a good sample of body fluid to test for DNA because it usually was destroyed in the test itself. Well, now they can take just a little bit and it replicates. You could go on testing it forever. So with every year, there's some new advance. Not the stuff you see on CSI. Some of it's true.
Right.
I don't even watch because I think they can't do that.
Oh, is that right? I thought that. I thought they had a forensic expert with them, guiding them through that.
Oh, they have a forensic expert. But I was watching a little bit of it one night, and they took a picture of the corpse's eyes, the lens of his eyes, saying that the image of the killer, the last thing he saw would be frozen on the lens of his, and I thought, no.
That's a little science fiction now.
Yeah. Who knows? Maybe one day, but not now.
It's very interesting, and thank goodness that we have that now, and so many people who were wrongly accused. We don't think that happens in our society with our judicial system, but I was really horrified to see that program the other evening.
I think my next book is going to be on a case like that. I won't say where it came from because I don't want to alert anybody, but I heard from a prosecutor somewhere in America who was instrumental in putting someone behind bars, and then through DNA, believes that that person is innocent and is working to have that person released. And I got communication from the prosecutor saying, would I be interested in writing a book like that? And I think I am.
Interesting. So, what is it in, let's go back to your latest book, Too Late to Say Goodbye, and Bart Corbin, who was the perpetrator. What is it in men like that that makes them seem so, well, they are unconscionable, I guess. Otherwise, they could not do something like that and then continue to function and remarry and have children. What is it?
And Bart, you know, actually knew that his little boys, who were 5 and 7, were going to find their mother's body. That, to me, that's almost as conscienceless as killing their mother. What I find is these guys on the outside appear to be very strong and in control, but inside they're nobody. They're weak. They need so much and so much affirmation that they really have no time or energy to care about anybody else. And this makes them, I think, conscienceless. They can do, they can move on where most of us would be eaten up with regret and remorse. They aren't. They just, he moved across the state of Georgia and started over. And the wife, Jen, his one and only wife that he killed, she did not even know that he had been involved with a woman who died violently a couple of years before she married Bart. She didn't even know Dolly had existed. So most of us couldn't live a lie like that, but he could. And many of the other books, Every Breath You Take and Never Let Her Go, Empty Promises, they're all, I swear, there's a whole subbreed of men and women like this, who use a facade of love to trap people, and then when they're ready to leave, dispose of them.
You describe them often as, I'm trying to think of some adjectives, but as having shark-like eyes, as though you look at them and nobody's behind them.
Yeah, I see that, and of course, you probably know that I worked with Ted Bundy at the crisis clinic 2 nights a week for more than a year.
Right.
And spent all night long locked up alone with him in this big old building on Capitol Hill. Looking at his eyes later, I could see that lack of I don't say lack of depth, because they were so deep that you just go in and in and there's nobody there. But there is something, poets have said, the eyes are the window to the soul. And with these people I've written about, there's nobody there. There really is nobody there. And but the smile is so good and the mask is so good that they can fool us. And we don't know until they peel that mask off who's really behind it. And with victims, sadly, it's too late. When the mask is removed, they're far away from anybody or any place where they can get help.
Yeah, and there have often been cases where the perpetrator is so charismatic that even if the victim tells people, they don't really believe them, do they?
No.
So I know you're very active with victims' rights, and what do we need to know as a community, as a country? What do we need to work on as priority?
Well, we need to, instead of complaining about laws that let people out of prison too soon, that aren't strong enough, or even if you think the laws are too strong in some instances, it's up to the people to, some will write up petitions, some people can sign petitions. So many members of the group that I belong to for more than 30 years, families and friends of victims of violent crimes, which is now located up in Everett, they're court watchers. They not only help families who are newly bereaved, but they will go and sit in on trials with them and observe judges and judges are voted for, and see how the law works. Prosecutors are voted for. We can't just complain about the way things are and say people should get tough on criminals unless we're ready to participate in changing laws.
Yeah, and I know that you've testified before the U.S. Senate Judiciary Subcommittees. I said that at the beginning of the show. Uh-huh. What did you talk with them about? What did you testify to them about?
On one, I went with Mary Miller. Mary is very active in Families and Friends. Mary's daughter, Kathy, was murdered by a repetitive criminal back in 1973. And we testified about victims' rights, about the need for victims to have support. When I started, there were not victims' advocates who would go through the steps of prosecution with them. And it's so scary. They have already had traumatic things happen to them, and to be plunged into the justice system without someone as a pal who knows the system to go along, it's very difficult. And then another time I testified on the need for VICAP, and that was our computer tracking program to find serial killers and to put different law enforcement agencies together so they could share information.
Mm. I know that you work very closely with the families when you're doing your research and putting your books together. You say that not just one murder happened, not just the victim was murdered, but there are many little murders and people around them die a little. What kind of advice do you give to people in that situation?
I almost feel presumptuous to give them advice, but the people I've seen who, there's no closure, and we like to say, oh, well, after the trial and the guy's in prison, there's closure. There's never any closure. Your life has changed. Somebody's gone. There'll always be that empty chair. But the people who seem to do the best and resume a life where they can have happy times are those who talk about it, who work to help other people, and participate in groups like Families and Friends. It's, I think, better than therapy in many instances to talk to somebody who has been there. I can think of two instances, and I won't name them. They're both gone, dead now. But women who, one lost her husband and one lost her daughter, and they stayed home and made their homes a shrine to the missing person and wore black all the time. And they never got better. They just...
They would stay stuck in that situation, wouldn't they?
Yeah, they just almost polished their grief and would not allow themselves
That seems kind of unfair to the victim to also destroy their own lives, too.
Yeah. The victim that they loved would never have wanted the person left behind to sit behind closed curtains and never have a life again.
Mm.
But I have a situation right now, and I feel real bad. I had four pictures that one of the mothers had given me, and too late to say goodbye. And when I carried them so carefully home, and I scanned them on my computer at once to be sure, you know, I had the images. I can't find them. I have spent literally 70 hours looking for those pictures, and I know that I'll find them. And I sent blow-ups of the images that I have, which are in many cases better than the originals. But that mother is just bereft that she doesn't have the actual snapshots. And I felt bad all day yesterday because she wrote and said how grief-stricken she was.
Yeah,
I know I'll find them.
Yeah, you will.
I have
you
had
will.
Pneumonia and three operations while
you
I was
will.
Finishing the book. And
right.
Things get kind of tossed, but...
Well, Anne, we're at the end of the show. Yeah. It's whizzed by, and I thank you so much for being with us, especially since you've had no time off at all. And
well, it starts right now.
There you go. I hope you have a great fall. And we talked today, of course, with Anne Rule. Her book is Too Late to Say Goodbye, and you can find more information about that at www.annerules.com. And if you'd like to share feedback on today's show, you can reach me at conversationslive.net, or you can call my 1-800 number at 800-495-7617. And I'd like to share a quote before we go today, which I thought was appropriate given today's topic. It's by Gandhi, and he says, "Be the change in the world you want to see." Thank you for spending this hour on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
We know what our food is doing to our bodies,
but what's it doing to our environment,
to our animals?
Speaker and educator Tina Volpe joins Vicky to discuss the havoc caused by giant corporations and how they're forever changing the face of farming and animal rights. That's Monday, September 24th at noon on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.